Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I've been very lucky over the years and the academic institutions that I've been involved with, and Keble's been a fantastic place to be involved with over the last few years, particularly with all the new developments and the Advanced Study Centre and these sorts of things in the wind. So I'm going to talk about what it means to be English, and I am not going to answer that particular question, as you might guess. I'm going to avoid it in various ways. So the standard academic ploy to avoid an unanswerable question would be to deconstruct it, to make it go away in some way, shape or form. But I'm not going to do that either, because I do think that a sense of national sentiment exists in England, in various other parts of Britain, and that we all feel drawn to our national identities in various ways, but in ways that are very difficult to pin down or make much sense of. The project that I'm going to talk about today is a project from the Pitt Rivers Museum. You may well not know this, but there are 44,000 objects from England in the Pitt Rivers Museum. They get rather submerged behind the totem pole and the shrunken heads and various other things. But there are more objects from England than any other country. And we called the project The Other Within because the collections had come in a slightly sort of subterranean manner and have never really been privileged. So part of my way of tackling this question is I will tackle it at a sort of general level, but more particularly I'll have a look at the particular set of objects. So there are all sorts of difficulties in defining Englishness. So I start with Peter Mandler's book. He says, this is a quote from him, "There is no necessary connection between the nature of Parliament, the boarding school, football hooliganism, fish and chips, snooker, the royal family, Monty Python, and Admiral Nelson, except that they're all said to be characteristically English. Yet the idea of," and this carries on his quote, "yet the idea of national character seeks to connect all such things to a single personality type, an effort that naturally demands a highly creative use of language and an equally creative treatment of cause and effect." So Englishness and any other national characteristic, we can feel that it exists, but once we try and get to grips with it, it's particularly difficult to do. And Mandler, like many people, and to some degree like me, less tries to define the English national character as uses it as a barometer for broader sets of political and economic forces within the British Isles and particularly within England. And I partly taken my cue from Mandler in that I shall argue that national sentiment is, I'm not going to argue that it's a barometer of other things, but that it is implicated in a series of discussions about values and about values more generally than nationalism. I'll come back to that point because it's a key point. Very broadly speaking, there are two models of nationhood. One is a broadly vernacular model, which is the nation as eternal, as natural, as ultimately unchallengeable. And all we need to think of is the opening lines of Jerusalem, which is in many ways the sort of unofficial English national anthem, to think how this is played out, how Englishness is played out in eternal terms. And it's distressingly easy to segue from something like Jerusalem into Flanders and Swann's rendition of "The English Are Best." And one of the things the English do well is parody themselves. The other model of nationhood is a deconstructive model, that nations don't really exist in some sort of ultimate sense, that they are imagined. And this book by Benedict Anderson, which came out originally in 1983, is the best and most influential statement. So Benedict Anderson says that nations exist as communities in people's imaginations because they don't exist as face-to-face communities. Even in a very small nation, you never meet all the other people in your nation. You never get to know them. They're not a community in the sense that a village might be or a college might be. They're a community at a very different level. And Benedict Anderson links the growth of nationalism to a whole range of things, but to things like print capitalism. So he says that once books and later newspapers were printed in vernacular languages rather than Latin or Arabic or whatever, then people gained a sense of nationhood and a sense of belonging. But that this sense of nationhood was very much a symbolic one rather than in some senses real. Nations were the outcome of modernity. And the newer a nation was, the more likely it was to claim that it was eternal. I take a slightly different view to either of these two views. For me, the nation is a project. It's not so much imagined, it doesn't just exist in people's heads, it's realised. Made real through landscapes, through cityscapes, through material culture. Now, it doesn't mean to say that it's really real in the sense that it is eternal and lasts forever and is unchallengeable, but it doesn't exist in the purely symbolic realm. It exists at a level of everydayness and is around us all the time. And this is one reason why nationhood has such a sort of powerful emotional charge. Nationhood is also linked to, as a process, to broader issues of process, how the world works, how the cause and effect operates, and also how moral relationships between people and the world work themselves out. Consider, and I'm always slightly wary of quoting this quote, but I will do anyway. This is a quote from a man called E.B. Tyler, who will become very salient in a few minutes. Tyler was the director of the University Museum of Natural History from 1883 to 1907. He's often seen as the originator of anthropology in this country, and he oversaw the coming of the Pitt Rivers collection, which became the Pitt Rivers Museum, which entered the University Museum as it did in 1884. So this is a quote from Tyler. "No one can dispute that the following groups are ordered correctly by degree of progress: the Australian, Tahitian, Aztec, Chinese, Italian, English." So for Tyler, history was progressive and it was leading to people like him. So and the staggering sort of ethnocentrism of these sorts of statements, which were quite unironical as far as one can tell, tell us a lot about notions of history in the later 19th century, but also tell us quite a lot about values. So for Tyler, world history was progressive, and he had a particular scheme of intellectual progress which underpinned everything that he thought about world history. So for Tyler, human thought, intellectual thought, shifted from a belief in magic to a belief in religion to a belief in science. And each of these were more institutionally based and more objectively correct. So for Tyler, he saw the discipline that he was trying to found, anthropology, as a science. It was something that should be empirically based, rationally thought about, and that rational thought meant that people were unswayed by emotions or subjective considerations, and that some of the peoples that he located further down the scheme of progress were down there because they were just too emotional. This is Tyler again on Englishness. "The English mind, not readily swayed by rhetoric, moves under the pressure of facts." So for Tyler, the world, the people were convinced, English people at least, were convinced by the empirical, the practical, the unemotional, the fair-minded. So that human history was a movement away from the emotional, the irrational, towards the rational and the empirical. So for Tyler, right at the heart of national characteristics, right at the heart of being English, was a series of statements about a whole series of other things, about the ways in which people understood the world, the ways in which people placed themselves in the world, and the ways in which knowledge was generated. So what I'm going to do in this lecture is look at these broader sets of values. And I'm going to particularly look at issues of science and magic and come back to Englishness later on. So this is the Pitt Rivers Museum, probably about 1910. So if you can read this, which you probably can't, this case at the front here says ancient pottery from the island of Cyprus. The Haida totem pole at the back there had been in place for 9 years, arrived in 1901. Whole range of other things. There are lots of English objects in there, but you wouldn't necessarily pick them out or recognise that they were there. So a few, being English, I've got to give you a few facts. So artifacts from England represent 79% of the UK collections in the Pitt Rivers Museum, 54% of the European collections, and 13% of the global collections. One could go on about various different facts. A graph, which again, you probably can't make out the details of. The blue line that you will be able to see are the waxing and waning of the global collections. This is objects coming into the Pitt Rivers Museum. We have the 1880s here, 2000 up the other end. As I said before, the Pitt Rivers was started in 1884. And the English objects are this green line here. So in some ways they mirror the global collections. In other ways, there are other forces around the collection of English objects. Just a few words about science, because science has been absolutely key to the setting up of the Pitt Rivers, the understanding of its collections. This is a fantastic shot taken in 1860 of the University Museum of Natural History, which was founded and opened in 1860. It was sometimes known as the Museum in the Parks because there was nothing else there, including the buildings that we're in at the moment. And the Natural History Museum was set up as an initiative by people like Ackland, who was a professor of medicine, and Ruskin, to try and bring together the rather scattered activities to do with science that were found primarily in colleges, places like Christchurch and so on. The old Ashmolean had a chemical lab, but there were rather scattered sets of labs and forms of empirical investigation to do with science prior to this point. And for Ackland and Ruskin, they wanted to bring together scientific endeavour into a single building. And in some ways, the 19th century history of the university is a shift towards science, and this building was absolutely key. It may seem anomalous that the Natural History Museum and the Pitt Rivers Museums are at the centre of the science area, but the science area is there because of the museums rather than vice versa. So this is a plan of the two museums, the Natural History Museum there, the Pitt Rivers collections over on the eastern side, and the Natural History Museum was divided into departments. There was medicine, there was mineralogy, geology, anatomy. But the court in the middle, which obviously still exists, has the dinosaurs and so on in it, was there as a key meeting point where people in these different disciplines could meet and talk. So it was immediately an interdisciplinary space. This plan, as you can see, is 1909, and by 1909, which is almost 50 years after the museum started, physics, the Clarendon Laboratory, has moved out of the museum, anatomy, physiology, and so on and so forth, and gradually moved across to colonise the science area. The Pitt Rivers collection, Pitt Rivers the man, Pitt Rivers conceived his collection as an aspect of mid-19th century science. He started collecting in the 1860s. His collection came here in 1884. He carried on collecting elsewhere until his death in 1900. The Pitt Rivers collection, as it was still known then, rather than the Pitt Rivers Museum, came into the Natural History Museum as part of the Department of Anatomy, which seems rather odd to us, but if you think in Darwinian terms, the anatomy department was there to help understand the variety of life and the movement from simple organisms to complex ones. And Pitt Rivers' collection, which was mainly of artifacts, was to do exactly the same thing, but within the artifactual realm. So Pitt Rivers was the person who coined the term typology, and he organised his collections in a series of types. So here he is, the man who gave his name to the museum, Augustus Henry Lane Fox Pitt Rivers, wonderfully long name, started his life as Lane Fox, ended his life as Pitt Rivers. And his collections and the museum that resulted from it were typological. So this is a shot taken of one of the upper galleries, probably in 1890. These are harpoons, mainly in this case from Northern America, but actually from across the world. So what Pitt Rivers did was organise his objects as types, and where possible, and it didn't always work, he was trying to demonstrate a movement from simple to complex. There's many things that one could remark on this shot, but one of the things I particularly like, and Mike O'Hanlon, who's here as the present director of the Pitt Rivers Museum, might like rather less, was that there was no glass in those days, and that you could take the objects off. And in fact, the teaching around the objects was students and lecturers taking the objects off, handling them. And Balfour, one of the moving forces of the museum, who started his life as a natural historian, and cutting up finches and dissecting things, used to dissect the objects, which Mike definitely wouldn't like the thought of, to look at their internal structures. So the point that I'm trying to make is that the museums generally are there as a movement towards science in the middle of the 19th century. The collections of the Pitt Rivers were definitely conceived within the idiom of science, and people like Tyler, who were key to the setting up of the Pitt Rivers collections, were very definitely embedded within this scientific endeavour. It's interesting to think, just as a total aside, in some ways, standing here in the Pusey Room, about the geography of this part of Oxford, where you have the centre of the science area just across the road, a construction of a very different type here that's to work through various issues within religion in the later 19th century. And there's a person who links the two. The opening, one of the opening great set pieces in the Natural History Museum was a debate between Samuel Wilberforce, the Bishop of Oxford, and Thomas Huxley. And that was the famous debate in which Wilberforce asked Huxley whether he was descended from a monkey on his grandmother's or his grandfather's side. And Huxley said, "I'd rather be descended from a monkey than a bishop." So, and pandemonium broke out. And Wilberforce, of course, was one of the moving forces in setting up Keble. So many of the big currents of 19th century history are played out in these few square meters around here with the museums. And of course, these aren't straightforward or any way antagonistic relationships, but they are complex and they are extremely interesting. The project that I'm mainly going to talk about is the Englishness project, derived from a previous project known as the Relational Museum Project, which Mike and I ran. And that was a project to look at the history of the museum from 1884 to 1945. And we were interested in the museum as something that was active. That the critique of museums is that they're far too passive, that objects are taken out of their original context, placed in this rather dead space, and then nothing much happens to them. We wanted to critique that and see museums as much more active and as a set of relationships which link ultimately the people who made and used the material, the various people who've collected the material, the people within the museum, the visitors, and so on and so forth. So what we did is an enormous number of statistics, and I won't give you even a tiny selection of them. If you're interested, there's a website through the Pitt Rivers Museum, Relational Museum website, which will give you more statistics than you can, even the English mind can readily want. So this, again, you won't be able to see exactly what's going on here, but this is a series of bar charts of different parts of the world in different decades, so 1880s through to 1945, and various parts of the world are represented differentially as material comes into the museum, and we can see a shift in the regional balance of the collections of the museum. There was a lot of European stuff in the early days, and Africa and so on. As Africa becomes more an active part of the empire, then the collections flowed into places like Oxford. And we asked a whole range of questions about the nature of the collections, one of which was, are the collections a map of the British Empire? Because many of the connections through which the collections came were imperial. Government officers of various different types, missionaries, explorers, these sorts of things. And the answer, as all good answers are to a big question like that, is yes, it is a map of the British Empire, and no, it isn't. But about, if you count the UK and countries within the British sphere of influence, then you have 70% of the collections up until 1945. And we took 1945 as our end point, because that's the sort of beginning of the end of the colonial period. So we were interested in the sort of colonial origins of the museum. And we were interested in a variety of particular collectors, one of whom, Tyler, who I've mentioned before and I will talk about in a minute more. And collections are very good indicators of people's developing intellectual interests and their social connections. So with things like collections, you get both things. You get the connectedness of the individual, the people from whom they collected materials, but also the things that they were interested in. So Tyler, for instance, was particularly interested in the notion of totemism, whereby some human groups identify very closely with an animal or a plant. And the totem pole was collected by Tyler as part of his broader sets of interests in totemism. We looked at the backgrounds of the people who've collected material in the field that ended up in the Pitt Rivers Museum. I'm proud to say, as an archaeologist, that more objects were collected by archaeologists than any other group. That's for the slightly sad reason that we do tend to collect a lot of rather broken stuff, and we're dealing with numbers here. So archaeologists collect lots of potsherds and stone tools and things. So numerically, we did better than anybody else, but whether quality is quite our milieu, who knows. But you can see here there are colonial servants, there are people in the army, navy, and so on. And what people collected was influenced to some degree by their general background. And also collections represent a sort of barium meal of the intellectual set up in the 19th and 20th century. So these are the societies that people belong to, where we know who they belong, what they belong to. So there's the Royal Anthropological Institute, the Athenaeum, the British Association for the Advancement of Science, Royal Geographical Society, Linnaean Society, Royal Society, and so on and so forth. So again, collections as objects can show us how people were related, how they related to a series of slightly more informal institutions. And because it was called the Relational Museum, we were interested in relations. So a moving force in the museum, Beatrice Blackwood, who was in the museum for a lot of the middle of the 20th century, one of the things that she was particularly interested in was stone tools. And we've just mapped here a relatively simple set of relationships. So these are some of the people that she got stone tools from. And they, in turn, often got materials from other people. So you can start to map the sets of connections between people. And it's worth noting this person's name, John Lubbock, Lord Avebury, who's in the middle there, who will become a player in my discussion in a minute or two. And the Pitt Rivers was also the basis for teaching anthropology from 1905, anthropology within the university, and people like Balfour, who's there on the left-hand side sitting down. You can see him here in the upper gallery handling his objects. And as I said, the students were able to walk around and actually physically interact with the objects. If you want to read more about the Relational Museum, available in all good bookshops is this book called Knowing Things. Complements the website. So one of the things that we discovered, and nobody had really worked this out before, was the prevalence, in fact, the predominance of English objects in the Pitt Rivers. And that did come as a surprise to all of us. So here again we have a bar chart of the English collections, the archaeology in blue, and the ethnography, and it's slightly tricky to divide the two, in red. And over the period from the 1880s through to the middle of the 20th century, there's a shift in a predominance of archaeological stuff to ethnographic material. The English collections come from all over England. Slightly unsurprisingly, the most stuff comes from Oxford. There's almost 6,000 objects from Oxfordshire. Many of the collections are rural because they're to do with craft and various things. But actually, we do have a large set of collections from Greater London, which sort of rebalances the rural-urban dichotomy. And being Pitt Rivers, there's a wonderful series of categories that these objects fall into. So these are the most prevalent 10 categories. So there's more toys and games than anything else. There's a lot of textiles, writing, boxes, tools, music, children, not children, as children, things to do with children. We'd get away with that, wouldn't we? Yes. And from Oxfordshire, there are lots of stone tools, many of which are very old, hand axes and those sorts of things. And generally speaking, the collections, the English collections, fall into three categories. The things that are very old, so archaeological things, Paleolithic through to, you know, Roman and slightly beyond, to do with in some sense, to do with grounding of Englishness, in eternalising Englishness. There are a whole series of objects which, when they were collected, were starting to go out of use. So the museum was electrified in 1904. Prior to that, there were gas lamps. And so at the period when the electricity comes into the museum, there is also a whole range of lamps and lighting equipment, because people were realising that this stuff was starting to disappear, and were collecting the things that were about to go, or were going, out of fashion. And the third category is sort of folk material and magical material. Just a slightly random set of objects, but they are so wonderful. This is a thing called a wit horn, which is made from the bark of a willow tree. And if you go hunting on Whit Sunday, you blow your wit horn. I'm not quite sure why, really, either to gather everybody together, I suppose. And this was collected in the later 19th century when it was still in use. This is an 18th century plate of a thing called a dandy horse, which is an ancestor of a bicycle. You might be able to work out that this particular dandy horse bicycle doesn't have a pedals and chain, that people were using their feet. So this was interesting for two reasons. One, because it's a plate, but also because it's at the time that the plate was made was a technology that was just coming in and starting to be important. There are considerable collections of things like textiles and lace. This is a lace bobbin, and when this was produced, it was a relatively common practice for men wooing a woman to produce a bobbin for them, in this case out of ivory. And you might be able to see there's an H, an N, and another H. This, in fact, has the name Hannah, if you turn it round. So it was produced for somebody called Hannah by whoever Hannah's amorata was. And this is a bit of lace, of which there is considerable amounts. Anybody guess what this object is? No, takers. It's a triple-decker mousetrap from Abingdon, which can catch three mice at once if you're lucky, and has all sorts of wonderful bits and pieces to do the mice in once they've got into the holes. And this is for Mark Pollard. This is one of the debates about nationalism as a whole is how far traditions go back to time immemorial and how far they're invented. Morris dancing. Mark, as some of you may know, is professor of archaeological science by day and has a whole different persona some evenings on, in any case. Headington Morris was refounded in the later 19th century, and one could debate whether it was refounded or whether it was more or less invented. I'm not going to make any statement about that at all, but this is a late 19th century complete Morris costume, complete with nice white hanky. So these are the sorts of things that that came into the collections, and you can see maybe at the back some of the Headington Morris dancers looking slightly unhappy about either having their photograph taken or being Morris dancers, who knows. So I want to, having talked a bit about science, I want to move to magic. This is the gentleman who I've mentioned a number of times, E.B. Tyler. E.B. Tyler is lecturing in this picture in the Anthropological Institute in London, and he is holding up an object which is still in the Pitt Rivers Museum today. If you go into the ground floor of the court, it's over on the right-hand side, and it's an object known as a witch's ladder, which was found in the attic of a house in Somerset, together with a couple of chairs and a broomstick. So clearly it was connected with witches. And Tyler was lecturing on witchcraft and magic as an element of late 19th century Somerset in London in the 1870s, and the object subsequently came to the Pitt Rivers. It's not at all clear. It's probably, and we've done quite a lot of research on the witch's ladder, it's probably nothing to do with witchcraft at all, and maybe much more to do either with hunting, as in trying to get your animals, the animals that you're hunting, the deer or whatever, all to go in one direction, or to keep animals out of your fields. So it's string with bird feathers, which sort of flies around in the wind and could generally alarm animals. But Tyler was quite convinced that it was connected with witchcraft. And here's the object as you will see it today. A slug on a thorn, which, as you all know, I'm sure, is to prevent rain. Clearly hasn't done a very good job over the years, but maybe with the drought coming up, it's just coming into its own. And this is an object I want to focus on for a little bit. This is an onion with a spring through the middle and a piece of paper around the onion, and the piece of paper is held to the onion by a series of pins. It was one of four onions which fell out of a pub chimney in Wellington in Somerset, the pub being the Barley Mow. Chris Wingfield and I, Chris is one of the researchers on the Englishness Project along with Alison Petch, Chris Wingfield and I did a very arduous bit of fieldwork in the Barley Mow, trying to work out where the object came from. And this is a quote from Tyler. In a low cottage alehouse, the Barley Mow, there certain men were sitting round the fire of logs on the hearth during the open hours of a Sunday afternoon drinking. When there was a gust of wind, something rustled and rattled in the wide old chimney and a number of objects fell into the room. Well, there were four onions, this and three others. And this may or may not be the chimney that they fell out of. There are a number of chimneys in the Barley Mow and we weren't able to localise exactly which one. The name on the onion that survives, and I'll go into why the other onions don't survive in a second or two. The name on the onion that survives was of Joseph Hoyland Fox, who was E.B. Tyler's wife's cousin. Tyler was a Quaker by origin, married into a Quaker family, a woman originally called Anna Fox, who came from Wellington in Somerset. And while Tyler lived in Oxford, as soon as term finished, he and Anna Tyler Fox would get on the train and go down to Wellington. So he spent a considerable amount of his time in Wellington in Somerset, which is where the Barley Mow is. So one of the names on these onions is of Joseph Hoyland Fox, Tyler's wife's cousin. And Fox, being a Quaker himself, was also very much involved in temperance movements, and the Barley Mow was known, as we have seen, as a low alehouse, and Fox and others were trying to get it closed down. Samuel Palmer, the landlord of the Barley Mow, was a known wizard. And this is almost certainly a piece of sympathetic magic to try and harm the temperance campaigners who were trying to close down the pub. What we haven't been able to ascertain, these onions were found in 1872, what we haven't been able to ascertain was whether Joseph Hoyland Fox suffered some nasty accident or illness around 1872, so we don't know whether the magic worked or not. Tyler, as was his wont, took the four onions, went off to London again to the Anthropological Institute, gave a different lecture on magic to the one that he'd given about the witch's ladder. He lent, after the lecture, he lent three of the onions to Lubbock, who I mentioned before, Lord Avebury, who was interested also in archaeology, magic, a whole range of different things. Things got nasty when Lubbock said he'd return the onions to Tyler, but they never turned up. So Tyler instituted some fairly conventional inquiries at the post office. He went to see whether this package had gone astray. But then, interestingly, in the 1870s, as well as being interested in witches' ladders and onions and various other things, Tyler was frequenting seances in London. And seances were seen as part of a relatively new movement in the 1870s. They were seen as American, an influence from the States, where people were trying to get in touch with spiritual powers of various types. Tyler wrote up a little bit about his experiences with spiritualism, and he saw most of the seances that he went to as being obviously bogus. People were rapping the table or doing whatever. But he said on a couple of occasions that he couldn't explain away what the results of the seance were. And he said that a number of the people who ran the seances, and this is a quote, were people of obvious intellectual power. As well as inquiring at the post office as to where his onions had gone, at least three different seances, Tyler asked the medium about the location of his onions. And on one occasion, an Indian spirit child, who the medium had connected with said that his friend still had the onions. On another occasion, the spirit in question said that they were in the possession of a large bearded gentleman, which in later Victorian London didn't narrow it down all that much. But the interesting thing about Tyler's inquiry at the seances was that he was interested in magic from an intellectual point of view, but he was sufficiently interested in magic to be a bit English about it, to be a bit empirical about it. And he couldn't quite help himself from testing out whether seances worked, whether spiritualism worked, and whether they might work enough to solve a problem that he was clearly very irritated about. Tyler, as I say, was a Quaker, born and brought up in a Quaker household. Quakerism was very important to him in his early life. Later on, he says nothing at all about his religious beliefs. He goes very quiet about it indeed, and it's possible. He still went to church, to the Anglican church in Wellington, but he goes very quiet about his religious beliefs. As I say, he was a self-styled scientist, and he saw anthropology. He termed anthropology as an emancipatory science. And one of the things that he felt that anthropology could do in terms of emancipation was to identify practices that were outmoded, that were unhealthy, that were unhelpful, and by identifying them, help root them out. Now, a key set of those practices were obviously magical practices. So the Tyler's rhetoric was that he was identifying these various magical practices, still being very much, you know, still alive and well in later 19th century England, but practices that one should do away with. But I think he was much more complicated than that, and his sets of beliefs were combining in many ways magic, religion, and science in quite an interesting mix. As well as going to seances and asking about his onions, he got quite interested in dowsing. One of the people who came to his house in Wellington was a well singer, rather confusingly, from Wells in Somerset, who Tyler tested out whether he could find water in his back garden. Tyler also hid his watch under a pile of carpets, and this guy found it. Tyler himself tried dowsing on quite a number of occasions. And it's interesting to think anthropologically, if anthropologists in the later 20th century were to approach things like magic or dowsing or whatever, the prime question they would ask is, why do people believe in this? What are the social and cultural forces that lead to this form of belief? Tyler asked a very different question. He asked, does it work? Which is a very interesting question indeed, and a question that by and large we wouldn't go for today. Tyler classed magical practices in places like Britain as survivals. So I apologise for the language in this quote. He says the thing is most interesting to me, as in finding the onions, as showing how the state of mind, which is that of a Red Indian or Kaffir, may be found still at our very doorstep. So again, the rhetoric of Tyler was that these things were survivals, magical practices were survivals, and in progressive late 19th century England were about to die out. This is another quote from him to do with survivals. But in actual fact, that wasn't quite his belief. And recent studies would see late 19th century magic not so much as a survival, but as a resurgence. There was quite a resurgence in vernacular magic, in belief in vernacular magic, in the later 19th century. And coincidentally or not, there has been a similar resurgence in belief in magic in the later 20th century. if we think of New Age beliefs, of pagans, of a whole range of people, the novels of Harry Potter, dare I say it. I mean, there's a whole range of aspects of late 20th century, early 21st century culture, which is about a resurgence of magical beliefs rather than magic being something that is about to die out. So as a slight aside, I would say that rather than Tyler's progressive movement from magic to religion to science, magic, religion and science always exist together, and they are emphasised in different ways at different times. And one might say, and I'm not sure whether this is true or not, that the rather secular movements of the later 19th century led the middle classes to science and the working classes to magic. As I say, I'm not sure whether that is entirely true. But when thinking about the world, then we think about a whole range of issues of physical cause and effect, how do things work, of moral relationships, what should be our relationship with the material world, with other people, and that a combination of magic, religion and society in many ways is much more satisfying than fixing on one or two of those. And of course, these issues are very topical at the moment. I don't know if people heard Richard Dawkins on Tuesday, was it, on the Today programme, talking about how Christian a society Britain was and whether we should admit that we were truly secular and do away with bishops in the House of Lords and a whole range of things. So the issue of the state and the nature of the state is still bound up with questions of religion, questions of magic, questions of science. So to come back to where I started from, being English is an unstable quality anyway. It's an important quality, but a difficult one to pin down. It's connected to a whole series of other unstable sets of qualities in terms of religion, science, and magic. And that these sets of values are areas of debate and difficulty, but help compound into sets of identities. I know less than I should do about the 19th century, but I do find 19th century people fascinating. And the reason they are fascinating, for me at least, is beneath the horrible surface, that sort of ethnocentric assurance and we're best, is a whole range of doubts about the ways in which the world works, the ways in which they operated within the world. And in many ways, the English collections of the Pitt Rivers Museum represent a series of subcurrents of doubt beneath the surface, whereby people were playing out various sets of difficulties in a way that they never particularly acknowledged publicly, but were extremely important. And one of the things that we're all saying these days about museums is that they don't just reflect the societies in which they exist, but they're part of the production of society. And these collections, with their series of different levels and sets of relationships, are productive in a small but important way to the production of things like identity, national identity, and so on. One of the things that I would take from all this is that the more we insist that we are one thing, the more obvious it becomes that we are many and multiple things. And multiplicity is a famous trope of Englishness, and possibly the most famous expression of this multiplicity comes from Daniel Defoe, and I end with a quote from him. From a mixture of all things began that heterogeneous thing, an Englishman. A mongrel half-breed race, a contradiction, in speech an irony, in fact a fiction. Thank you.